years and set this sort of separately, so it's really exciting to talk about it together and that it's getting more recognition. So I'm really happy about that. So I'm going to plow through. I practiced my slides last night and I realized I could talk for like an hour and a half, so I will try to plow through it. Not like that though. Okay, let's go back. Okay, so I'm going to just go through some stats and some substances that we see used in eating disorders. I probably will skim over the risk factors and brain chemistry and blah, 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 because that's not interesting anyway, but I have it on my slides, and if you want to take a look, that's totally fine. I'm happy to share my slides. A little bit about treatment, which of course is changing always. So resources, and I'd like to talk a bit about my experience with treating these for almost 15 years. Okay, so first of all, before I even forget, changes are happening. Elspeth is like spearheading a group that basically addresses both eating disorders, substance use. We're bringing in a new therapist, thanks to Kyla at the BCH Eating Disorder Program, and they're even thinking about starting groups, which I'm petrified of doing, but I think I might have to be involved. And we're knowing more and more that really we need to treat this together as a whole rather than separately. And if anything, I probably will forget, if anybody has any questions to me, I have to leave out a little bit early, I'm happy to answer questions. And I work at Ravensong, I do a lot of addiction medicine there. I focus mainly on opioid use disorder, so if anybody has any youth, they can send them my way, that's fine, I'm happy to see them there. So eating disorder, ED is eating disorder, substance use disorder, SUD, I'll just shorten that. Comorbid rates are high, as we intuitively would think. So I've read 50% of patients with an eating disorder will abuse either alcohol or some sort of illicit substance versus 9% of the general population. So that's a huge number. And vice versa, 35% of alcohol and illicit substance abusers have an eating disorder versus 3% of the general population. So the co-concurrence is really, really high, and so it's good that we're starting to talk about it. In terms of youth, high school female, female students with eating disorder symptoms are twice as likely to report smoking, drinking, or some sort of drug use compared to those without eating disorder symptoms. I thought that was interesting. Teen girls who smoke report greater body image concerns than non-smokers. Teens who drink alcohol are significantly more likely to engage in unhealthy dieting behaviors. And by the fourth grade, 40% of girls report dieting of some sort. So we need to, I'm glad we're talking about it more, because we know that when these two occur together, these patients tend to have worse eating disorder symptoms, poor outcomes, longer recovery, higher relapse rates, more medical complications, and as Colleen Wittig calls it, the whack-a-mole, when one is in remission, the other one often comes to the surface. Mm-hmm. Higher rates of suicide and death. And I thought this was interesting, so I put this one in. Studies suggest that patients who develop an eating disorder prior, so before a substance use disorder, struggle more with mental health than those who develop a substance use disorder prior to eating disorder. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I feel like that's reflected in the patients I see as well. So the substances used in eating disorder most commonly are alcohol, caffeine, and tobacco. That's why they're starred. Other stuff that we do see are stimulants such as amphetamines and cocaine. We had one patient in the BCH program, she used a lot of cocaine and was having chest pain. I'll talk about that in a minute. Opiates, I see a lot of that because I focus a lot on opiate replacement therapy, so I see a lot of that. Comorbidity and also THC. other stuff, insulin, I've seen that being abused, thyroid medications. I won't go into these so much. Laxatives, which is a huge one, and anabolic steroids. So what do we know? So patients with bulimic features appear to be at highest risk for a substance use disorder, whether that is anorexic, you know, binge purge subtype. So the bulimic features tends to be at higher risk. There is some evidence for substance use disorder among RAN is anorexia restrictive subtype. And that's a bit mixed because some studies I read reported increased risk, some studies reported no increased risk and just pure restrictive anorexia. So let's just talk about, I'm sorry, I need to go a little faster. Are you telling me?
Yeah.
Okay, alcohol. So again, more common in the bulimic kind of side of eating disorders. So bulimia nervosa, also binge eating disorder, anorexia nervosa, but highest, like I said before, in bulimia nervosa. 30% of BN have a history of alcohol use disorder, and it may also be a risk factor for development of an eating disorder. That was interesting. Caffeine and tobacco may be more prevalent in anorexia versus bulimia for both caffeine and tobacco. Those are some of the studies I read. But use is greater overall amongst eating disorder population versus controls. Mainly used as an appetite suppressant. And I see a lot of this in both my eating disorder patients and my substance use disorder patients. Amphetamines and stimulants may have a higher rate in anorexia. Purging subtype seems to be more associated with dieting purging behavior over just BN on its own. Again, appetite suppressant. We need a little bit more research to clarify, you know, where is it the most common. I see a lot of stimulant use, mainly crystal meth, at youth detox. So the youth detox I work is there's a lot of stimulant use, and like the whack-a-mole thing, they come into youth detox and they're on the ward and their eating disorder is ramped right up, and it's really tricky for the staff. THC, definitely increased prevalence in eating disorder versus controls. Oddly enough, I have seen it as well. It can be used as an appetite suppression in some people. It can make people feel nauseous. There is something called hyperemesis, THC syndrome, that I have seen. So in some people it suppresses their appetite, some people it doesn't. It's the one of the most frequently used drugs among anorexia nervosa, and who all may also use stimulants. So I do see also this a lot at youth detox. People think they don't need to go to a youth detox or a detox for using cannabis, but there are people that come to youth detox just for this. Opiates. So this is what I do a lot. I see a lot of youth with opioid use disorder, and I have to say hands down that all of my patients who have an opioid use disorder have a history of an eating disorder as well. They share very similar brain pathways. Endogenous opioids, the kappa, mu, delta, all those fancy names. And like I said, I see definitely, we don't ask about it enough in my substance use clinics. And with the opioid crisis here, we need to learn about this for sure. Over-the-counter medication, I'm just going to briefly talk about laxatives. It is the most commonly abused substance in eating disorders, up to 75%. Eating disorders and laxatives may have a higher level of comorbid psychopathology, like perfectionism and personality disorder. Other stuff, and of course, laxatives have a huge medical complication rate and issues, and it's really, really, really hard to get people off their laxatives. It's tricky. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I'm going to skip this one. What do I want to say about this slide? I think we kind of know this, puberty is a bit of a risk factor, especially for young females, not so much in males, but more in females is a risk factor for eating disorders in females. Early puberty is also a risk factor for development of substance use disorder. And early identification is definitely needed, right? Because adolescence is this very vulnerable time. And I thought this was interesting that I've read. I mean, we kind of all know this. Eating disorder is also cited in the literature, more commonly presents prior to a substance use disorder. So we need to screen everybody for both. I have to say, in my eating disorder population and my teams, we are very good at screening for substance use disorders. Alternatively, in my substance, and again, this is what I see, it might be different other people see, in my substance use disorder clinic detox, we don't screen for eating disorders. Mm-hmm. So that is a change that needs to happen. So I feel like the VCH treatment the eating disorder treatments team are definitely moving forward a bit faster than in terms of recognizing both in the substance use disorder teams. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So in terms of treatment SSRIs, there is some studies about opioid antagonists like Suboxone because they do share similar pathways. Again, and Elspeth will go into this too, we all know that we need to treat this together and that's what needs to happen. You know, I know Elspeth will go into this a bit more too about resources, but naloxone kits are a great, if you're worried that there's somebody in your home that might be using opiates, a naloxone kit is a good thing to have. I actually brought like a whole whack of them. I have a whole bag over here, so I'm happy to leave them here. And, you know, sit down and eat with your kids is a really great screening tool for both of these things, I think, for parents. This is the free online training course for naloxone. You don't have to like go to a course anymore and like watch a nurse. You can just go to this website and learn how to do naloxone training. And Elspeth is going to go through some resources too. These are not very looking friendly, I see, but Foundry BC I love. It's a great website. It's super youth friendly. It's awesome to navigate. I was doing it the other day. The other thing I wanted to point out was some of the apps I have listed there. Sangwen, Habitbull are really good. And a lot of the CHCs do have youth addiction counseling. So I work at Ravensong, that's one of the places. And they all have naloxone kits. So those are great resources. And then I just put down the youth mental health drop-in times, and these are at the CHCs, and they are drop-ins for youth and anybody concerned with a mental health disorder, including eating disorders. They will see them at these intake clinics. Although, I mean, it's a good resource, but it takes time to actually move on to the next step. But it's a good start. Of course, Kelty, good resource. I know it says Kelty on it, but those are the links for the VCH program, the Richmond program, and I didn't put yours down because I assumed you would put that down. There's a great app called Rise Up and Recover for eating disorders for youth. I got that from Foundry, actually. It looked like a really good app. And I think I need to finish because I'm done. So I did mention before that really all of my substance use disorder patients, especially my youth, have struggled with an eating disorder at some point, and I'm really happy that we're talking about it more, and because a lot of my eating disorder patients describe their eating disorder as an addiction. Like when I say I work in addiction, they're like, oh my God, it's like an addiction. So yeah. And I also, yes, I talked about this too, that really in the substance use disorder world, in my experience, we're not screening for eating disorders as much, and that hopefully will change a bit more. And also substance use disorder treatment is not as caregiver focused. I'm finding that also is something that's just my experience. I know that I might not be reflecting other people's experience, but at my youth detox and at Ravensong, we're more youth autonomy focused, and we don't tend to bring in the families as much, whereas in my eating disorder treatment, we tend to try to bring in the caregivers and families a bit more. And I feel like that's super important, especially in youth. So right now in substance use disorder treatment, I think we're just trying to get them engaged however possible. And we're not necessarily trying to engage their caregivers and families as much. So we can really learn from both sides, I think. Yeah, and I just want to talk about destigmatization, which is going on. But, and then also what is recovery, and that can be different for a whole different people. We just really need to meet patients where they're at, and that's how they move forward. Okay, I'm done. Thank you.
And our next panel member is Elspeth Humphreys, who has a master's in social work and is the regional coordinator for Fraser Health Eating Disorder Programs. She's worked in community mental health for over the last 19 years, with 15 years being in the field of eating disorders. And she is also the chair of the Provincial Eating Disorders and Substance Use Working Group.
So I don't know how to find my presentation.
Thank you. Thank you for that kind reminder.
Yeah. No, that's okay.
We're low tech.
So my expertise has been more in eating disorders for the past 15 years. But over the years, I've really developed an interest because I see it more and more happening in our youth and our adults in our programs. Having probably increased use of substances, as well as having a lot of challenges around treatment. So I'm part of a provincial meeting, and we've been talking about it over the years, and through that there was interest from across the region to develop a working group. So I'm going to speak just a little bit about that work and some of the projects we're doing. And then I also really want to talk about, because I think families, one tool that could be used, that's being used in some eating disorders program, is emotion-focused family therapy. And I would love to see that through all of mental health and substance use services. And then a little bit about how weight bias in the home or around fat talk can have an impact, and really about how to create a safe environment in the home. And then some resources which are probably very similar to what you had to say, maybe a little bit of differences. So the working group that we developed was back in June of last year, so we're fairly young, but we have representation. I'll talk about that from across the province, and this is kind of what our mission statement is about. So really, we want to build capacity within our existing healthcare services, both in eating disorders and substance use, and try to see how we can collaborate and have a more integrated and more effective approach, really, that's really client-centered as well as involving families. So that's sort of our hope and goal. And some of those folks are listening now and probably have more expertise than I. So we have great representation from each health authority, which I think is encouraging for families to know that in all health authorities, people are really concerned, and they want to improve services and they want to help youth who are struggling. So we indeed have representation from MCFD, from our tertiary residential programs, and also from substance use treatment. And I have to say I'm very encouraged, because I think most people see the need and are very excited and wanting to shift how we practice. So some of the things within our substance use working group that we've done is we've had a few grants, and one of them, we're looking to create some education for those working in substance use services to see a need for more integrated treatment. So Dr. Adele LaFrance, who is co-developed emotion-focused family therapy and has worked in eating disorders for a long time, is helping me develop the education modules. We're almost done, and the goal is to provide some education. We're not going to shift people's practice, they're going to need more training, but is to give them an understanding and an interest in looking at an integrated model, and also seeing families as a really important piece to providing treatment. So not just offering support groups, but actually involving them in the treatment of their loved one. So we're going to take this course, we're going to turn it into some online courses for healthcare professionals, so anywhere in the province, people working in substance use treatment can access, hopefully, this training and see the need that they want to start screening or working with eating disorder programs to offer more treatment. And I think we've talked about basically a lot of this that Vicky talked about already, so I won't go into this too much. But again, it's just, you know, what I often see in our population is when people go into, you know, inpatient or residential treatment for substance use, the eating disorder symptoms worsen. And unfortunately, sometimes people are discharged as a result of that early, or they choose to leave just because of the shame and guilt they experience from people not understanding what they're going through and not feeling like they can be open and talk about the eating disorder. So I think it's, you know, there's definitely room there to improve.
Can I just ask, is SM self-medicating?
Sorry, good question. It's substance use or misuse.
Or misuse.
And eating disorders. Yeah, I know. Okay. There's so many acronyms. Sorry about that. And AUD is alcohol use disorder. So
okay, thank you.
Apologize. And I think we've pretty much already covered this, so I won't go into that too much. Really, how what I see at the heart of the issue and what I do a lot of education on when I go out and present is that, you know, the symptom, whether it's an eating disorder or whether it's someone using substance use, it's really the same. It's about coping strategies that that person is using to regulate stress and really the emotional pain or trauma that they've experienced. Everyone's story is different and unique, but really it's about how to cope and them self-soothe or medicate the emotional pain or distress that they're in. So we don't need to be afraid. It's basically, there's a lot of similarities between the two. And so the treatment someone receives in substance use services or eating disorder program really can address both. But we do need to be aware and asking about it. So in a lot of the research and some of the papers that I read, this was what they talked about, really important in terms of engaging youth in treatment. So we know that resistance to treatment is common, both, you know, in eating disorders and in substance use. Ambivalence is normal. And, you know, the level of motivation to seek and engage in treatment, you know, is critical to success. So how can we do a better job of engaging them in services? And really, you know, I think it's important to stress that families can have a really positive and supportive impact by being involved and having a significant role in their loved one's treatment. I'll talk more about that. And that, again, you know, building trust, enhancing motivation, we know this, and engaging family are vital areas to focus on. So whether that's in eating disorder treatment or substance use. This is some of this research that is out there to show that really caregiver involvement is really important. And I think it's important to acknowledge that families are really stressed out. I can't imagine having a child who has both an eating disorder and substance use, how stressful and difficult that must be. They also probably feel a lot of blame or guilt or shame themselves. And maybe feel like they don't know who to turn to or ask for help. And so when you can acknowledge and validate and reassure a family member and give them some tools on how to help, that's going to make the world of difference for the recovery of their child. So they can play a role in reducing the behavioral symptoms. So whether that's providing, say, meal support for someone with an eating disorder or helping them reduce the amount they're using a substance, as well as helping them process their emotions and be able to regulate their emotions. And what we know through neuroscience is, you know, a family member can do so much more than we as clinicians can. So we don't want to lose out on a really effective strategy when we know that recovery, you know, takes time and is difficult. So another just strategy or rationale for engaging families. But, you know, the eating disorder and the substance use obviously don't just infect the loved one, they infect the whole family system, right? And, you know, many clients live at home. It's expensive to move out these days, regardless of age. You know, I have people in 20s, 30s, 40s still living at home, still being involved with their caregivers and families. And that, you know, for some people, they either drop out of treatment or maybe refuse to come for treatment. So what we know is that if we can access and support the caregiver, we can still have an impact on recovery or impact on that loved one then seeking treatment maybe down the road. So even if the loved one won't come through the door, we could target the families and support the families. So in our programs in Fraser Health, and I know in Interior Health and various other places, we offer emotion-focused family therapy, which I won't go into exactly the model, but it's basically rooted in the belief of the healing power of families. We believe that families are 110%, you know, motivated to help their loved one, but they're also 100% scared and they don't know what to do. And we also think that our clients are, you know, desperate and wanting their loved ones involved, but again, they're 100% scared and afraid that it won't go well. And so we try to address those concerns. So in our program, we offer different workshops. We're doing a two-day intensive workshop, for instance, this Friday and Monday. And we offer workshops over 8 to 10 weeks. And the first thing we teach them is all about emotions, about eating disorders, certainly we could do a better job around the substance use piece. And then we teach them how to emotion coach their loved ones. So how to attend, label, and validate their loved ones' emotions, which can be really hard. It's hard to validate sadness or anger or things like that. And then we teach them how to meet their child's emotional need. So every emotion has a need, and we teach them how to provide that. And that really scaffolds their child to be able to eventually do it for themselves, right? Because that's the goal. When a person is able to feel their feelings and cope and meet their emotional need, they no longer need an eating disorder or the substance use. Recovery coaching is where we teach families how to do things like meal support or help with other behaviors, if either reducing those. And we use the emotion coaching while they do it. And then relationship repair. We know that in families there's been lots of ruptures and stress and problems, sometimes within the marriage and within other siblings. And so we teach parents how to repair the relationship with their loved one and take off some of the guilt and blame that their loved one carries as a result of their eating disorder. And then the processing emotional blocks is really helping families be able to process those emotions that are gonna make it challenging for them to be there for their child. And one thing I always like to talk about for families is we live in a world of weight bias and stigma, which is basically where our internal thoughts, attitudes, and beliefs, we unconsciously judge people based on body shape and weight. And we're doing it all the time. We talk negatively about our own bodies. We talk negatively about other people's bodies. And we make judgments or assume people are not healthy if they're not a certain size, or that they are healthy if they are thin. And so I think it's important for families to recognize their own biases and to ensure that their home is free from that bias as well as fat talk. And there's some links to some videos here. We don't have time to watch them. And unfortunately, they are geared towards women, but I think that for boys and men, it can also have an impact. But really, it's about creating a home environment where parents don't talk negatively or say anything out loud about their own bodies or about anybody else. And really that their child is valued not for their appearance, but for their qualities, their strengths, their interests, their passions. Because that can really help someone be able to recover from an eating disorder. Because it's really challenging if people are talking these things at home. So I always encourage, you know, if you want to comment or make a, you know, on someone, you know, comment on their smile or, you know, the scarf they're wearing or, you know, you look so happy today, you don't have to comment on weight loss. So here are some resources, probably very, very similar. But what I did include is there's some websites that offer, if you don't have EFFT in your area, there's some websites where you can go and learn more about it, as well as watch some free webinars where you can learn the skills or learn how to support your loved one. So I think that's really encouraging. There's another good video put out about weight bias that you can watch. I think that one's about 20 minutes long. And then as Vicki talked about, there's child and youth mental health and substance use services all across BC. So this is a link to a map so you can find one in your area. And again, the Foundry also has a really, really great website. And I know from working with the Foundry that they're also trying to incorporate screening for disordered eating so that maybe we don't get to having an eating disorder. And they also know about referring out to our programs should they find a youth that needs support and services out there. So that's really, really encouraging. And these are just some of the references. So yeah, that's it.
Thank you, Elspeth. So just in terms of any of the resources that have been mentioned or shown on some of the slides, for those of you who are on the phone, all those links and resources will be put on the Kelty website along with the recording of the pinwheel. So I just thought I'd put that out as a reminder. And then also for anyone else who's on the phone, if you could just press *6 to mute your line. We're just going to hear from Lisa Burns, who will actually come off mute. And she's a parent with lived experience and has supported a loved one with an eating disorder. And we'll spend the next 10 minutes hearing from her.
Hi, everybody. Thank you. Thanks very much for including me in this as a parent voice. I neglected to get Bryn a list of, a bit of a bio on myself because I was preparing to go to Chicago for the International Conference on Eating Disorders. So just quickly, I am a co-founding member of International Eating Disorder Family Support, which you can find on Facebook. We're a global community of peer-to-peer support for those caring for a loved one with an eating disorder. I'm also the Canadian Task Force Chair for FEAST, which is Families Empowered in Supporting Treatment for Eating Disorders. I am a member of the Provincial Eating Disorder and Substance Use Work Group, and I'm a co-founding member of the World Eating Disorder Day of Action. I am the parent of a now young woman, she will be 24 in October, who was diagnosed with anorexia binge purge subtype in September of 2011, just shortly before her 17th birthday. We have run the gamut. We were in Ontario at the time, and my child was either too young, too old, too sick, or not sick enough to obtain any kind of services through any of our provincial agencies. So we pretty much went it alone. She did decide to leave home at 18 and a half, refusing any further treatment for her eating disorder, and by then we had educated ourselves on family-based treatment and were prepared to dig in and do that, and instead she left home. So she's actually been out of the home now for about 5 years. We built a scaffold within the community around her when she left so that at any given time I could locate her or know where she was. Through, we've not had substance use up to this point, although recently she has started using marijuana in order to quiet her mind in the evenings, which is typically when she will binge and purge. I am keeping a really close eye on that. So far, it seems to be more recreational in that she's not using THC during the day. She is holding down a part-time job that involves her working 3 days a week. And because she does have that bulimia component to her eating disorder, it's a hard call as a parent when I see her able to manage that aspect, but also the concern as to the interaction with her medications and whether or not this is ultimately going to be more of a problem for her than it is at present. In the peer support work that I do, though, we do have a lot of families with mostly adult children with eating disorders who also have substance use disorders. I'm so delighted that this conversation has started because the experiences that they've had is that if their adult child, both male and female, has both an eating disorder and a substance use disorder, they cannot get concurrent treatment. So they either have to go in and receive treatment for their substance use issue, which of course then pushes
my lock.
Which of course ramps their eating disorder issue right up because they're not being refed or monitored with meal support.
The eating disorder thing.
Sorry, there's someone who's coming through on the line, and I'll just ask you to press *6 and mute your line so we can just finish hearing from Lisa.
Thanks, I moved on to this. And then, of course, if they're not being accepted into eating disorder treatment locations because of their substance use issue, so it becomes a one or the other. And the possibility of having an environment where the whole person could receive support and help is very much needed. The statistics that the first speaker gave are staggering. That we're 50% with an eating disorder also have a substance use disorder. And the conversation beginning and finding ways to support these individuals is very much needed. So I think I'll leave it at that.
That's great. Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome.
So that wraps up the speaker portion of the event. I also know that Dr. Claussen mentioned that she might have to leave early. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to start and open the question period. So I will start with telehealth and see if you have any questions for Dr. Claussen or Lisa or Elspeth. So if you want to take yourselves off mute, if you have any questions. Any questions at the telehealth site? You can just,
Hi. Hi, I have a question about, Elspeth mentioned the importance of addressing weight bias and fat talk with the families when they're doing family therapy. In the modules that you're developing that are going to go out to other healthcare professionals in the substance use area, is that also included?
Yeah, I usually refer them. I always refer professionals to Balanced View. So they'll definitely be balancedviewbc.ca is a great free resource for healthcare professionals to address weight bias and stigma. And you can, it takes probably about 2 or 3 hours, but you can stop and start it and you get a certificate. I think there are credits for physicians as well.
And that resource can be found on keltimentalhealth.ca under resources for healthcare professionals, as well as on Kelty Eating Disorders website. Any other questions from anyone in the room at telehealth, PCH?
No, we don't have anything else.
Okay.
Thanks, Lisa.
And for those of you on the phone, if you have any questions for our panel, I know it'll be a bit of a free-for-all, but you can press star 6 to come off mute, and we'll take the questions as they come. We'll just give everybody a minute to come off mute, just in case there is any. Okay, not hearing any, we'll turn to the room to see if anyone has any questions for our panel.
I just have a question for Lisa. Lisa, are you familiar? I know that you mentioned your daughter was using marijuana and you didn't know how that interacted with medication, but there is a website that was designed by our pharmacists and mental health and others, www.drugcocktails.ca. And this website.
Sorry, it was distress or destroy?
Drugcocktails.ca.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
Yeah, so it's a website where you can plug in your medication and then it will tell you how it will interact with the different substances.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
And it's Lisa again. I just actually had a comment that I didn't want to let go without saying something in regards to Elspeth, including the family. That is so needed. I just came back from the ICE conference in Chicago and also the Feast of Knowledge one-day event on the Sunday in Chicago that we ran afterwards. And families want to be involved. They are so willing to absorb every piece of information, take advantage of any time that clinicians will spend with them so that they can be the best support for their loved one. And I just want to tell you how refreshing it is to hear clinicians talk about how much they value the family input.
Aw, thanks, Lisa. We worked hard. We had some fears ourselves. But I have to say that working with families is one of my favorite things now. I absolutely love running the groups for families, and it's still one of the few clinical things I get to do. So, and I love talking to families on the phone, and I just think that they're so, desperate for support, and they just need some encouragement and support.
They absolutely do.
Yeah, yeah. So hopefully, I'm pushing hard in our health region. I just presented to leadership about it, and to substance use services, and I'm trying to put on some more education about involving families. So I think we're getting there.
Slowly.
Well, thank you for being willing to do that. And if I can, if there's anything that you need from me, absolutely just ask.
Oh, I would love that. We're starting up a patient and family advisory committee for our region, so I might
get your
expertise.
Absolutely.
Any other questions in the room? Yes.
Yeah, for Dr. Klassen, I work at a local high school. I'm wondering if you have any good screening instruments, screening tools for eating disorders.
Yeah, there is. There is one called the SCOFF questionnaire, and it's. I should have put that up there. I can find it and email it to you if you want, or to Bryn.
Yeah.
And it's. So it's SCOFF. There's five questions, and it's like UK based. So they base it. One of them is on pounds or something. I can't or something like or
stones.
Sorry, stones or something.
Yeah.
So
sorry, Lisa here again. I've got a phenomenal resource if you want to write this down.
Sure.
It's www.feedyourinstincts.com.au.
So feedyourinstincts.au?
Yeah, .com.au. It was developed in Australia with their Center of Excellence there in eating disorders, and it is amazing. Amazing tool for families and or anyone in the education system. If you think someone may have an eating disorder, you can go through their checklist and, you know, have a read through, check off all the things that fit, and then there's tons of resources based on, okay, yes, I really do think this person has an eating disorder, what you can do next.
Yeah, and the other that's great, thank you. The other resource is also, Foundry has one very similar to that. It has these, you can do it yourself, so a youth can go on and do it themselves, or I mean, you can do it as a parent or a caregiver, and it goes through a series of questions, and then at the end it will kind of tell you, okay, yes, you should probably go see help, and here's some other resources and some apps and that kind of stuff.
Okay.
So Foundry has something very similar to that, and it might be the same thing, I don't know, where you kind of go through these questions and it gives you a little bit of idea where you're at the end of it. So the Foundry website is really good for that, yeah.
And sometimes in terms of pre-screening, you know, if you're seeing anxiety or if you're seeing depression or if you're seeing substance use, it's probably a good time to, or if you know that someone's dieting or reports that they're dying or dissatisfied with body image, you know, doing a medical history or doing questions around that, it would be a good indicator to use one of those tools. Mm-hmm.
One question that I had is sometimes we get calls in the Kelty around resources around just starting these conversations. So whether that's maybe from school professionals or family members, is, you know, what do you recommend in terms of resources or maybe just in terms of, you know, language? Where do families start to have these conversations?
You want to answer that? I think it's challenging because I think if you're afraid, we tend to start to want to drill our children. I think it's sort of trying to find a place where you're in a calm state, and I think being curious and really, you know, validating what you're seeing in terms of how their emotions and stuff, like really getting, like, you seem really down these days, you know. You know, I can imagine you're under a lot of stress and, you know, know what's going on, but kind of coming at it through that approach where you're saying it's okay how they're feeling, and maybe through that approach they might start to open up and talk about it. You know, it can be really difficult, and oftentimes you either are met with silence, we tell families, or you're met with rage and anger, and, you know, they'll come at you. So it's difficult to, and that's what we teach families, is how do you then deal with either the silence or the anger. But sometimes you have to dig and be patient and come after it time and time again. It's not necessarily going to be successful the first conversation that you have. But, you know, I always say trust your gut. Like, as a parent, trust your gut. If you think something's wrong, there probably is. You know, talk to the family doctor, talk to other professionals. But,
And having just come from a conference where we had the opportunity to talk one-on-one with some people who are in really strong recovery from both eating disorders and substance use, one of the really telling things that there was a consistent message from everyone was, for the families, be honest, be calm, remind them, you know, just reassure them that they are loved, and two things. Number one, your child is hearing you, even if they come at you with silence or anger, and to remember that anger is often the end result of fear. Your child is afraid, so to help them acknowledge that it's okay to be afraid and you're safe here is really important. But that thing of your child is hearing you, and to not walk on eggshells when you feel that there is an issue, but just to be honest in a very loving way. I'm worried about you. You know, they hear it. They're taking it in every time you say it. I love you and I'm worried for you. They hear it. So don't be afraid to open the conversation.
Great suggestions.
Thank you.
I have a question. I'm just curious about body dysmorphia and where that kind of falls in. Is it part of eating disorders or different from eating disorders, like separate?
It definitely can be. And people can also have it. I remember years ago when I worked in mental health having a client who had it, who had obsessive compulsive disorder, some eating issues. So that's in my experience. I don't know what other people's experience, but and also just to put in a plug about men and boys as well. I know we talked a lot about girls today, but you know, men and boys, the rates are between 25% to 40% of those are struggling with eating disorders, they're often overlooked. But they still struggle with body image issues as well. Can definitely struggle with both eating disorders and substance use. And sometimes they might turn to steroids or GHB or other things to look a certain way. Yesterday I presented in a men's treatment center, and there was lots of comments and questions from a whole range of ages of men about struggling with their own body image issues. So it's important to normalize that and to talk about it.
And GHB, what would that do
for a body? Maybe that would probably be better for Vicky to answer. I'm not sure.
Okay.
I don't know all the science medical stuff.
Oh, okay. Okay, thank you.
I have my limitations.
Right, yeah.
I can always, if you want, you can email me your question and I can forward it along to Dr.
Code Red, Jones and Woman's, 3FM. Code Red, Jones and Woman's, 3FM. Code Red, Jones and Woman's, 3FM.
My apologies for those on the line. Code Red means fire, a suspected fire. But we're fine. It's not in our area. So thank you for listening. Any last questions? Okay. Well, I'd like to extend my sincere thanks to Elspeth and Vicky, who just stepped out. She had to leave a bit early, as we mentioned, and Lisa, who joined us on the line, and to everyone else from telehealth on the phone and in person. Thank you for taking the time to be here. Again, the event was recorded and it will be made available within a week on keltymentalhealth.ca, and we also have our eating disorder specific website that you can check out as well for a number of the resources that were mentioned here today. And again, that will also be listed on our website. Thanks very much. And our next event will be May 31st, our next pinwheel, and it focuses on parenting challenging behaviors in younger children. So thanks again. Have a great day.
Thank you. Thank you. I'm the nurse clinician at the Provincial
Children's Cancer Center. Thank you. There's so many people that I find that are really interested in this.
We're happy to work over lunch hours to see that when it comes to when they can. Even our schedules are full and busy.
We understand.